Welcome to episode 28 of the Language Neuroscience Podcast. I'm Stephen Wilson. My guest today is Rob Cavanagh. Rob is a research data analyst at the Observational Health Data Sciences and Informatics Center at Northeastern University. He's been doing some really high-quality, methodologically rigorous work on aphasia, and I got in touch with him to talk about his dissertation, which he just completed at the University of Pittsburgh under the mentorship of Will Evans. It's called Determinants of Multilevel Discourse Outcomes in Anomia Treatment for Aphasia. Okay, let's get to it. Hi, Rob. How are you today?
I'm doing great, thanks.
So what time is it there over on the east coast of the US?
It is a little after 7 p.m. I've finished up dinner with my parents, actually, which is quite nice.
Okay. And you've got like family too, though, right?
Yeah. Yeah. My wife was also there and our dogs. Yes.
Yep. Okay. So I like to ask people at the start how they became the kind of scientists that they are. So can you tell me a bit about what you were interested in when you were a kid and what led you to this place?
Yeah. Well, I suppose I should have gone back and listened to a few of your podcasts to prep for this question, but I don't know that I have any like sort of foundational memories as a kid that led to this place currently, but I think a lot of how I think right now, I think I was always the kid who asked why too many times, annoyingly so, and sort of picking at the premise of everything, even if I don't know that I was doing, I didn't know that I was doing that at the time. And that has sort of percolated throughout my sort of academic experience, and certainly is a big part of what I enjoy doing now, which is asking like why, like why do we do things like this? Why did we do this in the first place? Does this make sense?
Yeah. Were you interested in language or neurological disorders or anything like that early on, or did that come later?
I was interested in rehabilitation and sort of helping people recover from injuries. And I was actually more thinking about physical therapy or occupational therapy as an undergrad. But I took a fantastic class with Mike Dickey, who you know, and became sort of fascinated with, like maybe intellectually at first, with the idea of what is aphasia, that like you could have somebody who knew what they wanted to say but couldn't find the sort of whatever linguistic aspects of communication to say it, and just that could be a phenomenon that occurred was so interesting to me. Okay. And that sort of spurred my interest in aphasia.
So you were an undergrad at the time that you took that class?
Yep. That would have been, I believe that class is actually a phonetics class, if I remember correctly. But Mike is obviously very aphasia focused, and I think that's where that started.
Okay. So you were doing an undergrad degree in what subject at that time?
Yep. Yeah. So that's at the University of Pittsburgh, Communication Sciences and Disorders. the details are fuzzy, but there was my distinct memory is just becoming very fascinated by aphasia, and then deciding that I wanted to be a speech pathologist, and that was what I was going to do.
Okay. And so did you become a speech pathologist at Pitt as well?
Yes. Not at Pitt. So I left Pitt for the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where I finished my master's and worked in research with Katarina Haley and Adam Jacks, who are still there.
Yep.
And great people. Working at the intersection, absolutely, of praxia of speech and aphasia.
I didn't know you had worked with them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I had a fantastic research experience, especially with Katarina and her lab, and she is just this person who, like, you have this idea and she will say, great, let's refine it. And why don't you run with that? That sounds fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a master's thesis with her on very mild aphasia. We eventually published the paper, which was just a very, very small qualitative study on the experiences of people with who were scoring sort of above the cutoff on the Western aphasia battery, so above 93.8, but still identified as somebody who had aphasia.
Yeah.
What were they struggling with? And maybe what were the service gaps? What were we not addressing for them?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I talk a lot with people who have very mild aphasia. And it's always interesting just to think how high they would score on a, you know, on an assessment, and yet how much this is still a big part of their life, and that's sometimes unaddressed.
Yep. And that was in, I don't know if, how familiar you are with Chapel Hill or Carrboro, North Carolina, but probably one of the highest rates of master's and PhD degrees in the state of North Carolina, or in Chapel Carrboro. And so, you know, I was interviewing people like somebody who had a doctorate in pharmacy or somebody who had a PhD, right? And they're essentially saying, you know, nobody can tell that I have this, but like, I don't feel like I can do my work at the level I was doing it.
Yeah.
We don't have a test for like language at the level of PhD scientist.
No, we don't. Yeah, that's really interesting. And so after you finished your master's, did you work as a speech pathologist for a while before coming back for your PhD?
Yep. Yeah, I did. I worked for 3 years, mostly in outpatient rehab, focusing on TBI more than stroke, but I had a sizable stroke caseload. And then, you know, floated where I was needed in the hospital to inpatient rehab. I worked in we had a specialty clinic for ALS. And so I did that, which involved a lot of AAC and counseling.
And then were you always planning to come back for a PhD, or did that just kind of like become apparent to you that's what you needed to do?
I think I always was thinking about it. I think if you asked Katarina, she would say, yeah, he was always thinking about it. I didn't know how long I was going to want to work. And of course, once you start making a salary, the salary of a PhD student becomes less and less appealing over time.
Yeah. where were you working at that time? Like what?
The hospital was Carolina's Rehab.
Okay. So you're in Charlotte, North Carolina. Yeah.
Yep. Which is a great you know, the hospital is a level one trauma center, and I was sort of nested in the main rehabilitation center. So we were seeing sort of the complex cases, which was intellectually interesting and then also quite challenging. And then also we were one of the few clinics in the area to take Medicaid. And so there's a whole other sort of aspect of thinking about access to care and disparities in care. Overlaid on top.
Are you from North Carolina, or that's just where you kind of wound up because you'd done your master's there?
No, I grew up in Durham, North Carolina for most of my childhood. So yeah, that was sort of going home for me, although my parents had left by then and had up here to Portland, Maine. But I sort of always identify with, you know, bluegrass music and, you know, summer nights on the porch.
Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the part of North Carolina that I know is basically the Great Smokies, you know, that's mostly as far as I got into it. Or Asheville. Yeah. Right. Lovely place to visit from Nashville.
Definitely. Yep.
Okay. So when you decided to do a PhD, did you know you were going to go back to Pitt, or did you kind of like have to like think about what you wanted to do next?
You know, I wasn't planning on going back to Pitt. I mean, so my wife who went down to North Carolina with me, I met at Pitt, and we were both just really loved Pittsburgh, this city. At the time I think I left Pitt, I think Connie Tompkins was at Pitt and running the PhD program. And you know, Mike Dickey does a lot of very sort of linguistically, theoretically motivated research, which as a clinician was not terribly interesting to me. I really wanted to do translational work. And so I might've reached out to like Melissa Duff at Vanderbilt. I'm pretty sure I had a conversation with Swathi Kiran at BU, and I had kind of put feelers out around. And then somebody introduced me to Will Evans, who was maybe in his second year at Pitt at the time. And Will and I just have extremely well aligned interests in terms of what we want out of research. And I think like personality wise, we just meshed from the get-go. And so that was kind of the obvious choice.
Okay, that's great. I think it turned out to be a really good fit for you based on what came out of it. Yeah, so that was what we were going to focus our conversation on today, was your dissertation, which I found really interesting. It's called Determinants of Multi-Level Discourse Outcomes in Anomia Treatment for Aphasia, as you probably know. And yeah, like, you're in a unique position that somebody's actually read your dissertation, i.e. me. Right. Because I don't think that anybody would ever have read mine. And I don't, and I think the modal number of readers for a dissertation, not counting the committee, is probably zero.
I'm a little surprised you're still talking to me, but you know, that's okay.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I think obviously our dissertations get read when they get turned into papers. But I did read yours because that's what I wanted to talk to you about. Can you kind of tell me and our listeners the premise of your dissertation without any spoilers as to the outcome?
Sure. So maybe I can start just briefly with like sort of the underlying motivation, which was as a clinician, I was doing lots of treatment with people with aphasia and questioning whether what I was doing was actually helping them when they left the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea really was sort of formalized in thinking about what generalization was in my first couple of years at Pitt, diving into some of the old school generalization literature from the behavior modification folks. So there's some sort of seminal works by Baer and Stokes from the 70s and 80s, which Cindy Thompson, I think, sort of took and crafted into a paper for aphasia in the late 80s. And so part of this paper came out.
Sorry, one sec. Were there any particular experiences with clients that really led you to question whether you were getting that translation to real world change?
Yeah, I mean, I can think of, it's interesting. I can think of people who I really like more so stuck to the book for what the treatment was. Like maybe I was doing ORLA, which is oral reading for language and aphasia. I apologize, Laura Turney, who I think is responsible for that, but I might be butchering that acronym. Which is a treatment that I really liked. And so I remember having a gentleman come in, and he was a former pastor, and I think he had retired, but he really wanted to read scripture and he wanted to be able to read it out loud to his kids. And so that, based on his ability level and his sort of language profile, that treatment was just really nice fit for him. And so we did it. And I kind of, you know, I tailored the materials and I tried to connect it to the goals that he had, you know, sort of trying to make those steps that we do as clinicians to personalize what comes out of research. But you know, he would tell me like, oh yes, it's helping. But he was also this very nice guy, and I don't think he would ever tell me that something wasn't helping.
Mm-hmm.
So I never knew, like, when he went home, like, oh, was this thing he practiced actually helpful if he pulled out the Bible and wanted to read to his kids? I can think of other cases where I didn't really stick to the book at all. Like I can think of, I had someone come in and they were working as an usher at a theater, and they were retired and had a stroke and had mild, moderate aphasia, but they needed to be able to read somebody's ticket, understand mm-hmm. where the seat was, and then, you know, greet them and right, and then guide them to their seat. And so we just drilled, you know, I basically made a bunch of fake tickets and we like drilled reading them right to uh-huh. work through numbers and things, which was totally unevidenced based. Like there's not a research paper that says go do that.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed logical. And maybe you could think about effortful retrieval. Like we could probably back, you know, in a backwards view look and find a treatment that I might have been doing inadvertently.
Yeah.
That seemed really successful because uh-huh. I was basically doing what they wanted to do, right? I was just providing the scaffolding and the cueing. So I think these two contrasting experiences are making me think about what is in our research literature and like how well does that generalize to the goals people have and like their everyday communication contexts.
Yep.
So then when you think about sort of the really popular treatments in aphasia, so semantic feature analysis probably being the most popular, if not in the top three.
Mm-hmm.
If I drilled a semantic feature analysis over and over and over again, how is that going to help someone in their everyday context?
Yeah.
At Pitt and at the VA, VA Pittsburgh, there have been a number of studies focused on semantic feature analysis. Audrey Holland, right, came through the University of Pittsburgh with an early study in the 90s using SFA, and Mary Boyle took off with this. And so SFA is all around me at the University of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, let's talk about SFA, because most of the people who listen to this podcast are not speech pathologists. So I would say that the actual mechanics of it will be unfamiliar to almost all of our listeners. And yeah. I'd love to just kind of for you to lay out, like, what does the session involve? Like, what are you doing with the participant, and what are you hoping to accomplish by it in principle?
Right. Yeah. So maybe we can just touch on the sort of I might call it the original version of SFA, mm-hmm. right, that sort of gained popularity in the 90s. So we have a list of trained words, which we have decided are important for treating. And I guess maybe the actual mechanics from a clinician point of view is I have a list of words and we're going to practice these words. And so if I have a word and it's like, let's say something simple. So knife, like a kitchen knife. I might present somebody with a picture of a knife and I would ask them to name it. And then mm-hmm. we're going to go around this sort of hierarchy, and I'm going to ask them to produce sorts of different semantic features for knife. So what is it used for? What does it look like? There's a personal association feature, like, can you tell me something about how you use this? Right. Or it might not necessarily be in that use category, but, so we generate semantic features around our target word. After generating five semantic features, we'll name it again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually it. We'll move on then to the next word.
Do you generate features even if they named it the first time through, or only if they fail to name it?
Usually, at least in the research literature, you would generate features regardless. It would not matter. Yep. And we also might be treating multiple words within a semantic category. So we might be training multiple kitchen utensils, for example.
Mm-hmm.
This idea being sort of in the classic version, if we train multiple items that fall in the semantic category, you know, knife and plate and so on, and we generate all these features in the semantic space that is like things that you find or use in your kitchen, we're doing some version of spreading activation throughout the semantic space, or strengthening connections between, like I'm thinking about the Dell two-step model, although I guess in my latest iteration of conversations, this hasn't really been out in the literature, but, you know, there are these connections that you might be strengthening, right, when you generate all these features.
Mm-hmm.
So we might train multiple words within the category. And the idea is that, we've strengthened the semantic space for kitchen utensils. And so even we didn't train fork, but we worked in that semantic space. And now you're better also naming fork in addition to knife, right? That's sort of the classic idea of what SFA is doing. And so we might not need to train like all these words that somebody has lost. Maybe we could train like a subset of them, strengthen semantics, and we get a bunch of other words for free.
Yep. So it would ideally generalize within category because of training those shared representations between semantic features. And I guess only the links to certain lexical items are trained, but you're going to hit a lot of other lexical items in the process of generating the features would be the idea.
Correct. Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So in SFA, we might do this, over and over and over again at VA Pittsburgh. The ongoing in the past clinical trial has about 60 hours of SFA. I think if I recall correctly, the trial that, came out of the University of Washington a couple years ago also was on the order of 50 to 60 hours. They were comparing, SFA and, phonomotor treatment, phonological mm-hmm. treatment. The original SFA studies weren't quite so high in their dose, or intensity.
Right.
But that is the treatment. That is it. There's kind of people have added to it at VA Pittsburgh. Actually, I've skipped a step, which is after the second time you try to name the word, we actually ask participants to put the word in a sentence with some semantically rich content, perhaps from features they've generated. The idea is that this might help with generalization. But that was certainly not in the original paradigm.
Okay. So if they've, like for a knife, if they've generated things like sharp and, cutting up vegetables, they might say something like, in my kitchen, I like to keep my knives sharp so I can cut vegetables.
Right. You would be a stellar patient. Yeah.
Yep. It helps to not have aphasia. It makes it easier.
Yep.
Okay. So that's the, as you say, you'll say that's a very popular treatment. I mean, I think I would agree with you. That's probably the most popular treatment these days.
Yeah. And Stacey just came out with, I don't know. I can't remember exactly what the design was, but she asked a bunch of clinicians what they do. And I believe SFA came out at the top of that list.
Yeah. It doesn't surprise me.
It's not just research where SFA is quite popular. It's also in the clinic.
Yeah. So, awkward question, but does it work for before we even get to your question of how it's going to translate to kind of real life discourse production, does it work for its intended goal of improving naming?
Yeah. So the evidence, if you look at, there have been a couple of different systematic reviews, and Gina Kike published a meta-analysis looking at all the different single subject design SFA studies, that we see robust improvements in naming for treated items. So these are the actual words that we're practicing.
Mm-hmm.
We see some evidence for generalization to semantically related but untrained items. Right. So these would be the words we think we might get for free. So it certainly seems to be person dependent. But on average, there does seem to be some effect. It is smaller than the treated items. And I will also maybe plug, there's a great paper by, I believe it's Lindsay Nichols in 2002. Who I think provided some compelling arguments pushing back against the generalization account to untrained items in SFA. So I don't think everybody is totally on board with it generalizes to untrained words.
Mm-hmm.
But
you're talking about untrained semantically related words right now, yeah?
Correct. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so what was Lindsay's argument? Can you recap her argument?
Not as well as she wrote it. Perhaps, but I believe the gist is we're doing a lot of probing of these trained and untrained words in these single subject design studies, right? It's pretty hard to disentangle the effects of repeated probing for words that we're not training from the generalization effects we might see in our treatment, particularly because these generalization effects are quite small and are probably similar on order of magnitude to what probing effects might be.
Okay. So just to kind of make it concrete, like you're training knife constantly, you got 60 hours, you're going to talk about knives a lot. And perhaps it's not that surprising that there is a demonstrable improvement in people's ability to name knives. But you're not training forks, but you're asking about forks constantly in your research design. And like that's actually giving you more practice with forks than you might have otherwise had. And so your fork naming might also improve, and it's not really because of the SFA. It's not really a knock-on effect from training knife. It's just because you probed fork a bunch of times. Is that the gist of it?
That is my recollection of the argument. And I think in certain study designs, that is, we don't have a way of necessarily statistically isolating those effects very well for a number of reasons. That is a whole other podcast and paper.
Yeah. And does it generalize? Okay, so we're talking about semantically related. Does it generalize also to unrelated words? And would you expect it to?
We would not expect it to. So that is classically the control condition, is that we have three sets of words in SFA in a research paradigm that we're going to train, or that we're going to probe: treated words, semantically related untreated words that we hope we'll see generalization to. And then we should have, provided we're controlling for all sorts of great psycholinguistic variables across our sets, untreated, untrained words, and we should see no movement in those words. Or perhaps the argument is, if we're seeing improvements in our related untrained words, it should be greater than the improvements in our unrelated untrained words.
Right, because some people, I think, and I think some people, I think Sharon, and how do you say her name?
Antonucci, I think.
Antonucci, yes, has argued that the mechanism behind SFA is more that patients learn to self-cue, right? So you talk about this in your dissertation, right? So if I'm having trouble naming knife, but I've practiced generating semantic cues as part of my SFA treatment, then I might start thinking, okay, it cards, it's sharp, and that actually kicks off my ability to actually name knife, right? So under that explanation, it ought to generalize to beyond to semantically unrelated untrained words as well, right? Because it's a self-cueing strategy that you've learned. Like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's plausible, and probably in my clinical experience, a more likely source of generalization. I'm not in my clinical experience where I've tweaked and tailored and, you know, turned SFA into something like SFA plus. That has been my experience that is probably what's happening. It is something about strategic communication, right? Somebody realizing how to use their system really well to navigate to their intended target, or perhaps an equally useful target. When they can't find what they want.
Right. Because maybe you don't need to say knife. Maybe if you just say cut sharp, your listener understands you and you can move on, right?
Right. Yep. Yeah. I think we lay that out in the dissertation as this competing mechanism, right? Yep. Perhaps it's not something that's, quote unquote, restoring the underlying semantic impairment, but it's system calibration, right? It's people figuring out how to use the system that they have in the most efficient way possible.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think is how much evidence is there that it, at a group level, does it generalize to untrained, unrelated words? Or would we question the empirical claim there?
I don't know of any evidence that SFA generalizes to untrained, semantically unrelated words when we're doing confrontation picture naming. I'm not aware that that's the case. I could be wrong. This is a good question for Gina. But by and large, I think we expect that effect to be null, and I think it has been.
Okay. Okay. So you'd really have to use it quite a bit. You'd have to train a lot of different, to have real world impact, you'd have to train a lot of different semantic domains, wouldn't you?
Right. I mean, again, in the research context where we get our hands tied behind our back a little bit in terms of needing to establish semantic control, or sorry, experimental control, not semantic control.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in the clinic, we clinicians might be a little all over the place picking all kinds of targets that might be useful. Maybe there's a breadth versus depth within semantic category versus spreading across them. But clinicians also don't have anywhere near the hours we have in clinical research to do the treatment. So
that's a whole other thing we can talk about. Okay. So in your dissertation, you've got people who are being treated with SFA as part of some ongoing clinical trials. Can you tell me about the patients who are taking part in those trials and the nature of the data you had to work with?
Right. Yep. So my dissertation focuses on 60 people with aphasia across two clinical trials at VA Pittsburgh. These are those intensive SFA trials where people are getting roughly 60 hours of SFA over 3 to 4 weeks. It's a lot of SFA. If you've ever done SFA, you can just imagine doing this drill over and over again for 60 hours across 3 weeks. Like, it's a lot.
Yeah.
The inclusion criteria for people is pretty generous. This is Will Hula and Mike Dickey. I should give them credit because this is not my study. This is their study. And Pat Doyle, before he retired.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone with a T-score above, I think, 40 on the comprehensive aphasia test on the auditory comprehension subtest. So we're basically looking for some evidence that they need some aspect of comprehension, right? We need them to understand the treatment, but the bar isn't all that high. We need some naming, like just a little bit, right? So if somebody can't name anything, they're probably not going to be enrolled in the study. And then the studies are also fairly open to including people. I don't remember what the upper tier cutoff is, but I want to say it might be, so the comprehensive aphasia test, like a T-score mean of 50, standard deviation of 10. I want to say that they might have needed to be under 70 to qualify, but don't quote me on that because I wrote this and it's a blur, you know. I think the fair takeaway is the two studies cast a wide net for including people of all different aphasia severity.
Yep. Okay. And I know that they weren't really designed to, they didn't compare SFA to a control condition, right? They were more looking at the effect of like how many features were generated and stuff like that in terms of the efficacy. So do you have efficacy data on naming from those trials, or was that not really the purpose of them?
Yeah. So the original purpose of the trials, well, there's sort of multiple pieces. There's a sort of neuroscience oriented piece that is more focused on imaging. You're right. There is this practice related predictors piece, at least in the first trial, where there's this question about sort of what is it about SFA that's associated with improvements. And we do see in these trials, like very, very robust improvements in trained items, at least in the first trial. I don't think that they have published any results from the second trial. In fact, I don't think that they can even look, because the study authors right now are blinded to a condition in the non-trial. But yes, we do see robust improvements in trained items. And I believe we do see some improvements in semantically related untrained items, though again, smaller in magnitude.
Okay. And then, so it's got that kind of near effect on the thing that's directly trained. And then obviously your big question is, does it generalize to more real world meaningful outcomes? So can you tell us about that and how you and what you decided to look at to investigate that?
Yep. Yeah. So this, the dissertation study came out of looking at, so this study, like many, many other SFA studies, in fact, I think many other anomia studies in general, collected monologue discourse samples from a set of discourse stimuli, which people now I think often refer to as the Nicholas and Brookshire protocol. So these are the Nicholas and Brookshire articles from 1993 and 1994. Both of these studies, the first trial that had 44 people and the ongoing trial, collected monologue discourse data. These discourse stimuli are, so some are sort of like open question, like, can you tell me what you do on Sundays? And others are responses to picture stimuli, like the cookie theft picture. It's sort of this hodgepodge of different discourse stimuli that have appeared in Nicholas and Brookshire, I think, if I understand right, sort of assembled them into these sets that could be used for research. And so both of these sets happened to be used in the study. And so I don't know what the timing was. I think if I recall correctly, it was pre-pandemic, but not by much. We were looking at the discourse outcomes for the first study and seeing that this measure that they were already scoring called discourse informativeness was improving to a small extent, but at least statistically reliably so after the first SFA trial. And I went, oh, that's interesting. I wonder why that's happening.
Did it surprise you to see that preliminary observation that it might have an effect on discourse?
Well, I'm a skeptical person, so I think I was surprised.
Yeah, I would have been surprised too.
as a clinician, I think would have led me to be a little surprised. But
And what is discourse informativeness for those of us that
go
measuring that all the time?
Yeah, so discourse informativeness is the percentage of correct and relevant words to the total number of words produced in a discourse sample. So you could imagine sort of, if I'm just going to like try to like de-jargonize this, it's like all of the words that make sense in the context and seem right out of all of the words produced in the sample.
Mm-hmm. So it's like what percentage of the words that you produce are correct and informative and on target, on topic.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. It's a pretty very widely used measure of discourse integrity in aphasia.
Yeah. And I think in the argument that I've made in my dissertation is that it is sort of the status quo discourse outcome measure in anomia treatment studies. If there's going to be a discourse outcome measure collected, it's probably going to be monologue discourse, and it's probably going to be discourse informativeness. I do think that's changing, but historically, I think that's the case.
So this preliminary data that you had, how many patients was that based off?
That was 40. That was the 44 people who completed the first trial at VA Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And it wasn't huge. It was about a 5 percentage point improvement in discourse informativeness. If I remember off the top of my head, something like on average, the group was 42% informative pre-SFA and 47% informative post-SFA, something like that.
Okay.
So not a huge change on average, but this is an average of a very heterogeneous group. So it's not nothing.
And yeah, I mean, if it's
worth the question.
If it's going to be statistically significant, then it's worth, you know, it's not nothing.
Right.
So, okay. So then in your study, you got to look at discourse informativeness in a larger sample of patients and also some other discourse measures too, right?
Yep. Yeah. And so the idea was, this is interesting. We should poke at it. Why don't we find, let's do it in a theoretically motivated way. Where, you know, we don't want to go fishing, right? So let's think about how we could dive into why this might be happening in a way that, you know, sort of answers maybe questions about what SFA is doing. Is SFA generalizing and how, right? We've talked about two different potential mechanisms for SFA, this sort of restorative mechanism that's focused on semantics and this compensatory mechanism where we think about compensatory communication use. And so the idea for the study was, well, discourse informativeness is a little bit tricky because it can conflate like relevance and correctness, which is a little bit challenging, right? But it's also only really one level of, it's like this, it's sort of a hybrid discourse measure. It's combining aspects of lexical retrieval and discourse and pragmatics.
Yep.
And so the idea is, well, why don't we pick a couple of different discourse measures at different levels of discourse to try to understand how SFA might be improving monologue discourse in these outcome measures? And this was motivated. My credit goes to one of my committee members, Davida Fromm, for turning me onto this literature, and this idea of multi-level discourse analysis. So this is sort of fundamental to the dissertation. So this is the idea that we might have different measures of discourse from the word level to sentence level to pragmatics, but these levels are all connected. They're not really isolated. And there's a study published by Marini in 2011, which kind of suggested that, well, you know, if somebody has this underlying linguistic impairment and we can improve the underlying impairment, that will kind of trickle up through the system, right? We fix the problem, and the remainder, the other aspects of discourse are kind of the symptoms. And so these improvements will sort of percolate throughout discourse. Or maybe our treatments are compensatory, and so we should really focus them on these aspects of discourse, maybe like informativeness, where we can get people to be more in tune with pragmatics. But that doesn't fix the underlying system. It just helps people use their system better. And so we wanted to pick measures that let us see patterns of improvements across multiple levels of discourse to see if SFA is doing something at this sort of core linguistic, right, semantic level.
Yeah.
And maybe that's trickling up to discourse informativeness. And that sort of would be like the core motivation for anomia treatments in aphasia, right? If I can fix naming, I can fix everything else. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the straw man. But that is like kind of the idea, right? So that could be a possibility. Maybe that's why we see improvements in informativeness. Or as you said, there's this compensatory idea. So maybe people just, they are not off topic as much, right? They're producing sort of, they're not producing inaccurate words as much. Maybe they're taking their time more. Maybe they're able to navigate to what they want more. They're self-cueing more. So we're seeing some improvements in informativeness. It's not really related to doing something to the semantic system.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the idea. And you know, in hindsight, and we can talk about, there are sort of some important limitations to how this actually played out. But this is where we started.
Okay. So you've got a bunch of different discourse measures. You're hoping to see that overall effect on discourse informativeness, but then you have specific hypotheses about which of the other measures would also move along with it, depending on the mechanism, whether it's a fundamental like strengthening of those spreading activation links versus the learning of a compensatory self-cueing strategy.
Yep, right. So myself and another research speech pathologist, Jen Golovin at VA Pittsburgh, went through and scored 4 time points of discourse samples for 60 people. It took some time.
Yeah.
I would not recommend doing that, although it was the pandemic, so it's not like I really had a whole lot of other things to do, but it was a lot.
Yeah, how long did that take? I think a lot of us have been through this in our career at some point where we've just done some brutal legwork through data. Like, how long were you at it for? How many hours a day? Like, how did you do it?
Yeah, I'd have to go back. I'd have to go and like look at the files to see when the timestamp started moving. I would wager that was at least 6 months of work at 10 to 20 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my off the top of my head guess. I was so fortunate that I had a dissertation fellowship from the NIH. So Will Evans at Pitt was great and basically said, great, you've bought yourself out of the lab, you know, stick around for the stuff you're interested in, but like, otherwise why don't, you know, go off and do the thing you proposed. It was great because I got, you know, this sort of firsthand experience in thinking about all of these discourse samples as you go through one by one, for the time that's interesting, which is, not all of it.
Right. No, but you do learn a lot when you're face the data up close and personal like that, don't you?
Yep. Yeah. Right. And I think that informed a lot of how I interpreted the results. I don't think I would have the same interpretations if I had just shopped that out to somebody else.
Yeah. So are we ready to tell our listeners what you found?
Yeah. Well, I feel like we're missing a small key piece of information.
Okay.
Which is what are the measures that we looked at?
Well, we talked about one of them, but we didn't talk about the others. Yes.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah. So for full disclosure, we sort of proposed slightly different measures initially and, had to shift for, graduating on time reasons and some other, concerns I had about, psychometric properties of some of the measures, but, we counted up all of the semantic errors in every transcript. So we wanted the rate of like, how often did people produce semantic errors, sort of controlling for the sample length, right? So this is like really getting at the idea of lexical semantics. If we think we're improving the semantic system, people should be making like frank semantic errors in discourse less often. We also looked at lexical diversity. So were people producing more words? We used a measure called the moving average type token ratio, which is essentially a type token ratio where we're again trying to account for sample length. this sample length is this very variable thing in discourse that is really orthogonal to what you are interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to look at grammatical complexity, and initially this was going to be focused on predicate argument structure, but it turns out that was not going to be a feasible measure for us to finish if I wanted to finish my dissertation within a reasonable number of years.
Uh-huh.
And also sort of the outcome measure you get from predicate argument structure, I think was going to be statistically challenging to look at. The compromise was mean length of utterance, which I think is a pretty good proxy for grammatical complexity. It's not perfect, but is certainly close.
Yeah, I think it's a good measure. I think it's a very robust measure.
Right, is faster because if you mark utterance boundaries, it's quite easy to calculate.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, utterance boundaries, as I'm sure you know, are not the easiest thing in the world. I mean, there are some icky questions that come up when you're trying to decide what's an utterance and what's not. But if you have some principles, then you know you can most of the time you can get to an answer.
Yep. Yeah. And you know, we started off with the code book and we had a set of rules which we sort of refined, and you know, you find all of the gray areas right as you go.
Yep.
And you say, well, we don't have a rule for this, right? Okay.
Yeah, your code book gets longer and longer.
Yep.
Yeah, it was funny. I've been teaching assessment to students here at UQ recently, and like they keep on asking me questions like, "What would you do when the patient does this? What would you do when the patient does this?" And I'm like, "It's not defined in the WAB. Like, you either just have to make it up. Like for clinic, you just make it up. For research, you'll end up with like a 300-page addendum that tells you how to actually score it. But it's whatever you do, the patient is always going to do something that's not in your rule book."
Right. Yeah. And I think, right. And as long as you're consistent, right. If it happens again, you treat it the same way and you're transparent about what you did, then what else are you going to do?
Yep.
And so, right. And so we kept discourse informativeness being the measure that changed. We wanted to, you know, we're adding an additional 16 people from this ongoing trial. So we have a total of 60. So we wanted to keep that measure in case it changes. And then sort of, there was going to be this fifth final measure of global coherence. It's interesting. Every person I talked about global coherence just sort of shook their head and were like, "Oh, I'm sorry." And sort of global coherence being like, how well does the sentence at hand relate to the topic? And I guess on the sort of several global coherence scales, these are 4-point or 5-point scales. The reliability of how well people can distinguish between the middle sort of the 2 and 3 or the 2, 3s and 4s on that scale is poor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice way of putting it. And I was essentially told it's probably not worth going down that path.
Yeah.
So, but in full transparency, we set out with predicate argument structure and global coherence. We did not do those. We dropped global coherence. We looked at MOU. We didn't analyze the data, right? We didn't make that change after seeing data. That change was made before looking at the data.
Right. That's very reasonable.
Yeah, this is the trials and tribulations of a PhD student, right?
Oh, any researcher, actually, right? I don't think it's specific to any training stage.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Right. So, what do we find? By and large, we found that people did not change in these measures. I've left out a small detail, which is, we have treatment entry or treatment enrollment and treatment entry. So we have two observations pre-treatment. We have a observation right after they finish and then 1 month follow-up. And in the case for these four measures, the change from immediately before the intervention to after the intervention is not large or statistically reliable.
Mm-hmm.
Does not appear to like even like marginally exceed what we're seeing in sort of the enrollment to entry change, right? So we get a sort of glimpse at variability without treatment.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got these four time points, two before treatment, one straight after, and then one to kind of look at retention or maintenance. And you're saying like any slight gains that you might have seen during treatment were of the same order of magnitude as what you were seeing before treatment even started. So just kind of like capturing natural variability.
And, and if, I, if yeah. I recall, I think people were might have been allowed to have, you know, whatever treatment, clinical treatment they had going on between enrollment and entry. So it's not a perfect control. And the time point, the distance and like number of days between those time points is hugely variable.
Yeah.
But still, it is there for comparison.
So, okay. So that's, were you disappointed that you didn't see effects on discourse in any of your measures? Or did, was it just kind of like coming back to reality?
I mean, I was definitely, I guess I wasn't surprised. I was disappointed, because this is sort of the idea, like, oh, we're doing SFA. And in this study, we're doing a ton of SFA, right? Like, we should see these effects if they exist, right? If like, mm-hmm. and especially you take the line of argument, if the effects of 60 hours of SFA are big enough for us to care about, they should be popping up here, I think.
Yeah. And what happened? Yeah. What happened to the effect from the prelim data? Was it just the extra 16 patients that made it go away? It had been a little bit fragile, or was there something different you did in your analysis that was more careful than the prelim analysis?
Yeah, a little of both. I think the statistical models we used this second time around were a little bit more robust. And maybe slightly more conservative, perhaps. But I think it also is pretty reasonable to think that there is some regression to the mean going on here. There are some intricacies of aggregated binomial mixed effects models.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about that.
We don't need to go into it. But I think it's a little bit of the modeling approach was a little more careful. And also there's some regression to the mean. We are pulling in 16 people from another study. The studies are very, very similar in their paradigm. They are slightly different. And I can't tell you that that isn't part of the reason. We might be getting different people in this enrollment cycle, who knows? You know, there are different clinicians who are involved, right? There's all kinds of things that could contribute to this. But to me, the two likely things are the statistical approach is a little more rigorous, and there may be some regression to the mean, right? We're seeing an effect that by and large we haven't seen. It makes sense for it to come back to where we started.
Right. So you believe that there's like, if there's an effect here, that it's very small at this point. You feel confident that your confidence intervals are narrow. If there is an effect at all, it's small.
Yeah, I think so. The effect for the group. So, you know, like we might distinguish like how much individuals change being meaningful for them. And of course that being difficult to distinguish from sort of like just variability, right. Mm-hmm. Between taking the test. But on a group level, and I don't know what the credible interval is off the top of my head, for the like difference in performance from post-treatment to pre-treatment. But the bulk of that credible interval is within a range that you would probably not care about as a clinician. You would mm-hmm. say that effect isn't, even if it's greater than zero, it's not, most of the effect is not big enough that I really care.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So you talk about this, you have this nice turn of phrase, train and hope. You say we shouldn't just train and hope. Your results show that we shouldn't just kind of expect generalization to real world outcomes without, you know, a sort of mechanism for it. Can you talk about the train and hope idea and getting past it?
Yeah. And like, there's so much I want to talk about just nested within that question. Like, if I didn't say something like monologue discourse isn't what real world communication looks like, I would probably receive an email from Marion Lehman as soon as she listens to this, assuming she listens to it, who is a fantastic researcher and discourse expert, and reminding me that monologue discourse is not the same as like dialogue, for example, and the conversations we have every day. So in the context that we are looking at an outcome measure that is sort of a proxy for this thing we want to improve, which is how people communicate in their everyday lives. The idea of, or sort of the phrase of train and hope came from those seminal papers by Stokes and Bear. And these papers from the behavior modification literature were essentially criticizing, this literature that came out of like, B.F. Skinner, like way back when, basically saying you can't like do a task and get somebody to get really good at a task in your controlled research setting and then just expect that they're then going to like take that out of your room and use it. That's not a reasonable expectation. But that is the dominant paradigm for how people look at generalization. And I think if you look at the aphasia treatment literature, at least the anomia literature, you will see the same thing, which is we can get people to name words pretty well, right? Those effects are pretty large.
Trained words.
Trained words, right? And in fact, at Pitt right now, we have this study where we're training people on a couple hundred words, and we're expecting to probably get them to, we're hoping that effect size is north of 100 words gained that they can name.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not enough. You need a theoretical mechanism for how you're going to get the use of those trained words into the context that the person cares about. So I think this, in my comprehensive reviews as a PhD student, I went back and looked through some of this literature from the 70s and 80s and 90s in aphasia. Like Pat Doyle at VA Pittsburgh is doing stuff where he's testing to see if the things his patients are doing, if they can use them with new clinicians or new listeners, right? Like this idea has been around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
That we should be making this sort of thing a part of our treatment. And so the way to combat train and hope is to think, okay, if I can, produce these effects in the task that I'm going to, rote train, how am I going to get them? How am I going to make this sort of ability useful to someone in the context they care about? Are they just going to practice it in that context? Maybe we scaffold the environment that they're doing training in. Maybe I really need to shake up my treatment, keep them on their toes, right? There's a great research project out of the UK right now called Luna, where the treatment is sort of working backwards from a personal narrative. So let's start with a story you want to tell. Okay, we're going to work on some linguistic aspects of the story using SFA. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to bring those words into the sentence level, and we're going to address how we're using those words we practice in SFA that we've already established that you care about at the sentence level. And then we're going to practice the storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of scaffold that's really oriented towards this sort of end result is kind of what I would like to see, I think, all of us doing. And I suspect is what clinicians do a lot informally, even if it's not so much what you see in the research literature.
Right. It's like script training with other forms of treatment to bolster the steps that go into script training.
Right. It's like if you took script training, but then you ask people to go practice, you went and practice the scripts with all different kinds of people so that, the people you practice with said the wrong thing, right?
Mm.
They didn't give you the right next step in the script. So you had to adjust.
Yeah.
Or right. That's not training and hoping. That's, sort of training for the use case, right?
Yeah. I mean, what did Pat Doyle find when he looked at the ability to generalize beyond even trivial things? Did he find that it made a difference that people, underperformed with a different clinician, for instance?
You will go back and read that study because I could not tell you. I could not tell you off the top of my head, and I don't want to make it.
Okay, no worries. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to read it because, I've always sort of wondered, how much of the treatment effects that are reported in the literature are kind of familiarity with the interlocutor, familiarity, you know, just that comfort with the person that you know, the room that you know, the situation that you know, like how much of the gains that are reported are just things like that. I mean,
oh, and it can be even more specific than that. Like when we train words for our nomia studies, we often have desired targets, right? So you know, show a picture of a rock and somebody says stone and you're like, eh, that's not right. And then when you get to treatment, you say, that's a rock. And they're like, oh, okay, rock.
Okay.
We're like, great, you've learned something, right? You're better. But you know, that's not really an impact we care about.
No, yeah, it's a good point. So where do you go from here? I mean, did this make you not want to do SFA anymore? Or do you just think that it needs to be part of a bigger enterprise?
Yeah, well, I think there's a time and a place for SFA nested within a, you know, holistic treatment program where it makes sense. Maybe you are focused on that strategic communication, right? And it might be a great tool for teaching someone that. I think I'm a little less convinced that, you know, if you really wanted to like train a few words and get generalization to lots of other semantically related words, I'm not sure. I think you'd be better off just training as many of the words you cared about directly. I think you'd be more likely to get the benefits you were looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But even still, I hope you have a plan for how you're going to get those words to be useful.
Right.
I think the Luna study and that idea, I think that sort of multi-level approach to treatment, not just the analysis of outcomes, I think that will be pretty fruitful. You know, we don't also have to train nouns, right? Like there might be many good reasons to start thinking about verbs as a better target from which to build a treatment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. There's also, I think, a question of measurement paradigm. We haven't really touched on it here, but there are a lot of challenges in measuring discourse outcomes after our treatments.
Yeah, you did talk about that a lot in your dissertation, and it's super interesting to me. I mean, yeah, let's talk about it. But I will say before we talk about it that at the same time, I don't think it's the fundamental, you know, explanatory thing here, because I do think that, you know, discourse informativeness was a pretty decent measure, and MLU is also a really good measure that's really easy to measure. So I kind of think that you did demonstrate robustly that there wasn't a meaningful change in their discourse. But all that said, let's talk about like why it's hard to measure discourse.
Right. Well, and I think a good pushback on like the hard interpretation of the null result here is like SFA, at least in the restorative sense, trains a discrete set of items and, you know, potentially related ones. Or if you're an effortful retrieval person, we're doing a lot of effortful retrieval of lots of semantic features. So perhaps that's also useful, right? But if the discourse stimuli doesn't actually elicit these things that we're training, we might not see benefits, right? So if we're just thinking about how does, you know, what we're training generalized to monologue discourse, this isn't really a strict test of that, right? Because we haven't sort of confirmed that, oh yeah, like Nicholas and Brookshire is really eliciting what everybody was being trained on.
Right. I mean, in fact, it wasn't, right? Because it was explicitly completely right. Separate. I mean, you'd have to basically ask people, hey, tell me about, you know, what, it, like, you know, getting back to our kitchen utensils example, your discourse sample would be, tell me about cooking a really complicated meal in your kitchen, you know?
Right.
And so, then you might see an effect.
Yeah. We are actually doing this at Pitt. And I say we, but I've now left, but where we are getting like a core lexicon measure out of all kinds of stimuli, developing lists for training words out of those stimuli. We will train them using sort of a classic anomia paradigm. And now we can look to see if the discourse, if discourse is improving, because we sort of have established a priori that the discourse tasks are eliciting what we're training. So it's a little bit of a stricter sense. But you know, the other side of this is like, well, we did 60 hours of SFA. If it really did enough to boost the system, it shouldn't really matter, Right. Like if you spent 60 hours really working hard on something and we think it's made a like restorative improvement to the language system, it should pop up on a general discourse measure, right?
Yeah, I would think so. Although I guess like at the same time, like, 60 hours, it sounds like a lot, right? And I'm sure it feels like a lot. But think about it this way. In your PhD, let's say you're working, let's say 40 hours a week. I'm sure it's more than that, but let's say it's 40 hours a week. 60 hours corresponds to the first 1.5 weeks of your PhD. Like, is relearning language easier than doing a PhD, right? I mean, not really, probably. I mean,
True.
maybe at the end of the day, 60 hours is a tiny amount.
Sure, it might be a tiny amount in a perfect world where we can deliver hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of treatment, but 60 hours is like the 99th percentile of what people get an outpatient once they go home. Like it's like 60 hours. If somebody gets 60 hours of treatment right now, at least in the US, of outpatient, we've done really well. Like they are a VIP in our outpatient clinic if they got 60 hours.
Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting that the solution would be to do more hours in the study. I'm wondering whether, by analogy, like whether we're deciding whether you do 10 hours or 60 or 300, perhaps that's like saying you've got to clear all the sand from this beach and you're either going to use this small shovel or this big shovel. Like I'm
Right.
just a little worried that that might be why it's not working.
Because we should be doing it. Maybe if we did 120, it would work. Or
No, it wouldn't. We'd need to do 120,000 or something. I mean, like the numbers are not important. But 60 is a lot more than 10. But like, what if the real number that's needed is so vastly more that like it doesn't actually matter that much if it's 60 or if it's 10?
Right, because we're orders of magnitude
Yeah,
short.
that's what I'm a little concerned about.
Right. Well, and this is your area more than it is mine, but when you think about looking at imaging pre and post treatment, right, which I think in aphasia has largely not seen huge changes after
I
interventions.
mean, this is something that we've studied, Sarah and I, Sarah Schneck and myself. I can say with confidence that there hasn't to date been a convincing demonstration of any neural changes following treatment. There's been many
So,
studies that have investigated that and that have reported changes, but none of them have been statistically robust in
right.
my
But
in my
so maybe
very
the question is if you had 120,000 hours of SFA before or after, between your imaging, would you see a change?
120,000 hours? Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, you probably would, but it wouldn't matter if it was SFA or not. You'd also have an effect if there was 120 hours of conversation. So yeah, I don't know. I'm just speculating here.
I will happily speculate with you anytime.
Yeah. So I know that this is, I mean, just to kind of wrap up our talk, I mean, like this is something that I know that you're working on now, right? So you're really interested in dosage and the disconnect between research dosage and actual clinical practice. Do you want to talk about what you've been doing since you finished your dissertation along those lines?
Yeah, that would be great. So I've shifted gears a little bit out of psycholinguistics more into health services, which is a little bit sort of back towards the motivation of why I left to do research, which was sort of thinking about like, how do I do the research as a clinician? Like, how well can I do this? And as the sort of PhD process went on, and as I keep thinking about it, it's like more and more coming back to like, I don't think the system is set up well for chronic conditions like aphasia in the US for us to be successful implementing our research. And the first steps in this are sort of characterizing what usual care looks like, right? Like how far off are we? And not that this is like the fault of anyone, especially clinicians. There are system level factors and there are clinician level factors and there are clinic level factors and there are patient level factors, right? Do people have transportation to the clinic? Do they have insurance on? And so where I'm hoping to take this work is sort of characterizing what the usual care looks like in the clinic and thinking about, well, what could we do differently, or what sorts of data or studies could we use to advocate for care that actually aligns with the chronic condition that is aphasia? The way the system is set up now, I think, we can have conversations about SFA all day long, but the reality is people are getting 7 to 10 hours of treatment and outpatient once they go home in the first year. It doesn't matter what treatment you pick in 7 to 10 hours, the effects are not going to be huge.
Mm-hmm. So even if you had shown an effect on discourse with 60 hours, you would still have a big hurdle in front of you in terms of, okay, then, well, how do we get people 60 hours? I mean, that's a whole another question.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you hope like apps, right? Like at this point, if you want 60 hours, apps are probably our best. We as clinicians have to give home practice that is, hopefully true enough to the treatment that it's doing what we're doing in the clinic. Not to mention all of the counseling and the goal setting and this holistic treatment, right, that we should be providing. Like if we were just doing SFA in the clinic, we'd be doing our patients a huge disservice.
Yeah.
That's where I would like to take things. And so like my research right now, I'm thinking about sort of the fundamental problems of this, which are as simple as, well, how do I identify somebody with aphasia in a health record or a claims database?
Mm-hmm.
How can I even be confident that the people I think I want to study, that these are the people in my cohort? And because our field doesn't do a whole lot of health services research, I think this is where we're going to have to start.
No, we really don't. I mean, I think it's whenever I've seen medical records research related to aphasia, it's like the first hurdle is like, oh, I mean, a bunch of them have PPA, right? Like you're just as likely to see aphasia in the medical record of somebody with a neurodegenerative as a stroke. And like a lot of the times they'll just use different words. They'll won't mention it at all because they're so taken by the motor impairment or, yeah, it's right. Not easy to extract from medical records.
Yep. Right. Yeah. The best I can do right now is something like, well, this person has no ICD records of a stroke for 6 months. And then all of a sudden they have some ICD codes pop up for stroke, and also two different providers punched in an aphasia diagnosis. And so I'm going to take a good guess that this is probably somebody with aphasia.
Yeah, that's pretty decent. Although you wonder, like, then did they get better? We know people get a lot better in their first year. Like, how are they doing after,
And who put in that code, right? Because I think that matters a lot.
Hmm. Yeah. So you're enjoying that new direction?
Yeah, it's a learning experience to really shift to health services. And, the center I'm in is really this intersection between health services, epidemiology, biostatistics. It's sort of where these different things come together. And these are not areas that I've been classically trained on. Right? Mm-hmm. So I'm learning by doing, which is always fun.
Yeah, it's fun. And it is fun to just keep on taking on new things and things you don't know how to do.
Yep.
Yeah. And so I guess the dissertation, you're working on a paper or papers to report those results?
Yep. I'm hoping to submit this in the next, 6 months. it is getting there. My goal is to submit, a single paper, right? The results, there's a whole aim too about cognitive predictors of.
I know. I read it. It was too complicated to talk about in the podcast, I thought.
I think it's predictable based on our conversation. I think I will bundle those as a single paper. Hopefully, maybe taking it to IARC down your way next summer.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, in Brisbane. To Brisbane.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. Yeah, well, best of luck with getting it written up. I'm looking forward to seeing the publication. I honestly don't think you have that much work to do. I mean, it's just cut off the acknowledgments and you're good to go.
I feel for the reviewer who attempts to read the supplemental materials that I've carved out for them at this point.
Yeah, it's all good. All right. Well, thank you very much again for taking your Sunday night to chat with me. And enjoyed reading your work and talking to you about it.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
All right. Well, I hope to see you in Brisbane mid next year.
Yep. I hope so.
All right. Take care. Okay. Well, that's it for episode 28. Thanks very much to Rob for coming on the podcast. I've linked Rob's dissertation in the show notes and on the podcast website at langneurosci.org. Thanks a lot to Marcia Pettit for transcribing this episode and the journal Neurobiology of Language for supporting some of the costs of transcription. Bye for now, and I hope to see some of you in Marseille next month if you can make it to the conference. Take care.